everyone, and welcome to Heavy Parties Heavycast episode 119.
Oh, you remember this time?
What? Sorry?
You remember this time.
Yeah, I remember this time. So, as you might be able to tell, we have Nick with us this week because Noyan is, you know what? I'm not going to do that. Noyan is a good friend of mine and he has a lot going on. Noyan is doing important things because he's an adult. I'm not going to sink to his level and make up some story about how he's, I don't know, selling drugs somewhere or has to take care of the bodies he has buried in his backyard or whatever. So we have Nick instead. Hey, Nick.
Hey. I don't think we've actually managed to do a cast together, just the two of us.
We did once when it was all three of us, right?
Yeah.
Back when I was in Brooklyn. But I don't think, yeah, we've had just you and me. So 119 episodes in and we're still keeping it fresh. So that's good. We're going to take this opportunity to talk about some stuff that I usually can't talk with Noyan, which is fine. You know, stuff that he doesn't care about. But also we have a bunch of terrible news items.
Ooh.
Yeah, I bet Noyan is kicking himself for missing this episode because it's just maximum salt. So let's get the good stuff out of the way and then we can dive into the nasty, nasty shit. Does that sound like a good idea to you?
Yeah, you know, either way, we're going to just be ranting and raving a lot, so let's...
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so before we get to the ranting and the raving, let's talk about some cool stuff that came out this week, music-wise. So the first thing is probably one of my favorite bands in the world, and I've never been quiet about this, is Caligula's Horse. I just absolutely love their brand of progressive metal, and you're also into them, right?
I'm into them. I feel like you feel the way about Caligula's Horse on a similar level that I do about the Deer Hunter, and like vice versa.
Yeah, that's a good comparison. I think, you know, for me, it's just I grew up on these kind of sounds, you know, a very specific type of prog that is kind of become terrible. Everything has been very repetitive for the last, let's say, I don't know, decade, if I want to be very use hyperbole about it. But Caligula's Horse kind of do that same thing and inject a lot of freshness into it. So I think that's maybe where you're coming from with the Deer Hunter and indie in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Indie rock, which has also kind of fallen into this mold and this kind of stale, repetitive template, and the Deer Hunter really mixed that up. So that's a good comparison. And in both cases, one of the most important members of the band is the vocalist.
For sure.
Well, in the Deer Hunter, he's the brain behind the whole thing to a degree that Jim Gray isn't for Caligula's Horse because he has, you know, band members who take, who make up a very important part of the band. But he's definitely one of the, linchpins of Caligula's Horse. And just another reminder of just how fucking good he really is. He posted, well, the band posted on Inside Out's channel. That's their label right now. An a cappella version. Well, there's a cappella on Graves. The last track from In Contact, the last album. And there's an a cappella there. And Jim posted a 56-second video of just that part with all the parts broken down. And frankly, it's just stunning. It's a really good look into what goes into making such a passage. There are like, what is it? 16 different, 8 different voices here. Mm-hmm. And he does everything. And I remember way back when I was in high school, I had a really good friend who is still a musician, a pianist. And he always told me that the best vocalists are those that can write harmonies for themselves and perform them themselves. Right? They don't need backup singers. They're just so good at knowing their own voice and knowing their tone and knowing the parts that they write that they can do stuff like this. And it's just really beautiful and impressive. You watch this as well, right?
Yeah. No, I mean, it's just pretty much flawless. And it does actually remind me, bringing it back to the Deer Hunter, of a couple of times that Casey has done similar things, like Act 3, there's that opening song, mm-hmm. Writing on the Wall, and in the, you know, the deluxe version of the album, he included just an a cappella version of that.
Yeah, it's super impressive. It's a really good look behind the scenes. It also reminds me of something that I used to do when I just joined the blog. In my reviews, I used to mention how many tracks I thought vocals had, and now I never do that because I quickly learned that it's always more than you think. There's just so many. It's true for guitars as well, and maybe even for drums in certain cases, but vocals usually have a ton of layering. That's really how you get those powerful, powerful voices. So just don't try and guess. And this is a really good example. Like, if I had sat with this segment and tried to listen to it, I think I would have gotten maybe four. I would have heard that coupling. So it's a really good look behind the scenes. And speaking of Australia and progressive music, we also have a new track from Pliny.
Oh, Plinky.
AKA, yeah, Plinky, Plinkus. AKA the only interesting thing in New Prog. Maybe for, except for like two more artists. But he's really like the standard maker for New Prog today. And he released a new track called Salt and Charcoal, which is very much, you know, there's a negative connotation to the term B-side, right? But I don't mean it negatively. It's just another piece of Handmade Cities.
Yeah.
His 2017 release.
He didn't include any information, like specifically stating it was part of those sessions, did he?
No, he didn't. And I think the people who produced this, well, the artwork as always is by Alex Pryle, I think you pronounce his name. He's a really good guy. He's a friend of some people on the blog, and he's an amazing visual artist. But I think the production was actually done at a different place than the album. It sounds a bit different, right? Some of the guitar tones are a bit more pronounced. Same place. Interestingly enough, the same guy, Simon Grove at Nerve Studios. So I don't know, what exactly changed here. Ah, I see. It's different people. Mm. Chris Allison did the drums while Troy Wright did it on the album. And Simon Grove did bass as well as production. Devesh Dayal contributed additional vocals and more production. So maybe that's the story here. But as far as the style and the color of it and the type, it's very much in line with Handmade Cities, which is fine.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly sounds like something that either was an idea that was left over from, you know, from what he had written for Handmade Cities, or, you know, something that he's written since that was just kind of in that vein. So it's fine. Like it's a solid Pliny song.
Yeah. And you know, you gotta consider the marketing aspect of this. You want to stay fresh. It's been a while since Handmade Cities was released. I think it's been over a year. It was one of the first albums from 2017, if I recall correctly.
This Bandcamp says August 2016.
2016. Yeah. Oh my God. So it's been actually longer than I thought. So you want to stay relevant. He's been touring like mad. But you kind of want to reach out to people and stay fresh. So releasing a single like this is a really good idea. Hopefully there's more, you know, full length or another EP in the works, and we can see him maybe try and push his sound in new directions. But yeah, for now, this is pretty good.
Fine.
Yeah. More from stuff that is mostly fine. Post-rock. No, I'm kidding. We actually have some really good stuff here. So post-rock is like what you and I do on the blog, what we collaborate on a regular basis. Right.
Right. I think it's probably one of the first things that the two of us really kind of bonded over musically.
Yeah. Yeah, no, for sure. I remember, I don't know who it was. I think it was Jimmy or Kyle who posted you remember your blog? The blog you had before.
Yeah, my blog / my shit Tumblr. Yeah.
Yeah, so they linked to that, and I don't remember which review of yours I read it, but it was some post-rock ensemble. And I think that was the first, yeah, like you said, the first thing we bonded over. And one of the first changes we also made to the blog, right? Mm-hmm. Allowing post-rock to be covered in like its own segment. So let's talk about post-rock. I feel like we've had a sea change, right? In our perspectives. Mm-hmm. 2 years ago, we were lamenting, not the death of post-rock, but kind of putting it in the same basket as indie rock, right? Falling into these templates, into these repetitive patterns. And mostly we're still correct.
Like, well, I think what we've talked a lot about over the past 4 years is that we've seen, you know, there are these obvious huge tropes in the genre, and particularly for a music that is mostly instrumental, it's really easy to fall into and rely on certain instrumental and compositional tropes, particularly when there's so easily identified with that post-rock or post-metal sound. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you have like, at this point, I think we've kind of decided there are, you know, there's like two, there have been like two major, very distinct waves of the music from the 90s into the early 2000s, and then like early, you know, early mid 2000s into the late 2000s. And then since then, we've been kind of trying to figure out what this next wave might look like. And we've spent some time identifying a few bands that might be indicative of, you know, where the music might be going. But I think really the past year or so, we've seen a swell in certain communities, certain locations, and networks and festivals and whatnot that are really trying to kind of coalesce what this new wave of post-rock might look like.
Yeah, so, you know, the accepted history adds, and like, this is the fourth wave, right? In the accepted post-rock history, like, third wave is all that stuff in mid 2000s. The first stuff is 80s and early 90s, and then the second wave is the big burst of bands, and then third wave is God is an Astronaut, all we lost the scene in the way, all that crescendo core stuff. And now I feel like what I post about on my profile and a lot of the bands that we spotlight on the blog are bands that are bringing groove back to post-rock and saying, you know, the build-up doesn't have to be this delay-ridden exercise in denial, right? Not denial in a psychological sense, in denying the crescendo and just keeping on. How long can we keep denying that catharsis? But instead, it can be something with rhythm, something with groove. I always talk about loud bass, loud drums, stuff that keeps the momentum going even when everything is not blowing up. And then the crescendo, which still exists, is all that much more satisfying because it's not like a pulse in the night. It's a series of lights. And I feel like what you said about networks and locations is super important because it's kind of been like a litmus test. You can see the, you can see the networks in post-rock, maybe because we're involved or we just lucked out, or maybe there's something specifically special about these, about this genre. You can kind of see how this stuff percolates and spreads. You have the New England scene that we keep talking about, and you can see how these bands feed off each other. This Patch of Sky, Man Mountain, West Meets West, and a bunch of other bands working in those areas. And then you can go over to the UK with the math post-rock scene. Mm-hmm. Right, Rumor Cubes, Town Portal, although they're not from UK, they're very much inside that scene. Vasa, who else? Who am I forgetting? The Physics, like, House Band.
Yeah, basically all the, like half the bands that we wrote about in our wrap up last year.
Yeah. Alpha Male Tea Party, all these guys. And then you go to Europe and you see, bands like Hubris and Below a Silent Sky and a bunch, and Mountain and a bunch of bands. And when you start looking at it, they all play shows together. They all do the DIY things together. They all make their festivals happen together. And that's so different from how things work in metal, for example, where you have promoters and big names and venues and stuff like that. And here it's all much more networked. So, and that fits so well with the music, right? That often, unlike metal, the emphasis is on strength and willpower and overcoming things together and wonder and a sense of community and a sense of coming home and stuff like that. So it's really interesting to consider those relationships. Mm-hmm. So I think that's like an overview of where we see stuff today. Do you have anything to add to this, like, intro?
No, except I think there is a lot to be said specifically for the people behind places like Dunkfest, and the people who have been trying to specifically kind of bring that really awesome community into America. And we've had, you know, we've been kind of building our own relationships with those folks and the bands and that whole network. And it's just a really cool has a really cool feeling to it. Lots of that old kind of DIY feel.
Yeah, and I think we'd be remiss if we didn't mention A Thousand Arms, mm-hmm. Who are fueling slash the infrastructure for this whole thing, right? A label that's publishing vinyl and digital releases and shirts as they do for us, for a ton of these bands, and kind of a hub around which these spokes rotate. And the idea with Heavyblog, the reason it's so important for you and I feel, is that this is the kind of stuff you want to shine a light on. Mm-hmm. A lot of blogs, us included, you know, when a big band that has a past behind it releases something, we're very quick to cover that thing and talk about its influences. But we also, the reason that we're different and we want to be different is to look at the stuff that's not coming yet, right? We want to shine a light on those spaces within the community that are doing new things. It doesn't have to be new things musically. It's new things organizationally, new things in a business way. So I think that's why we've put so much emphasis on this series and why we've reached out to these people, because it really feels like something being born. And I think that's really special and really unique. And, I hope we can keep covering it. So we mentioned a bunch of bands. But I wanted to talk about some releases that we've recently come across, that really blew us away. So do you want to take the first one?
Sure. That being Below a Silent Sky.
Yep.
Yeah. So, funnily enough, so like a lot of what I've been doing the past few months in kind of putting together these new curated monthly columns focusing on post-rock and metal is I've been just going to Bandcamp and searching post-rock and pretty much anything tagged with that and just trying to find anything that really strikes my fancy. And mm-hmm. I came across Below a Silent Sky, I think, maybe a week or so after inadvertently you had already kind of come across them.
Yeah.
So they are, where are they from? They're European,
are
they?
Is it Germany or Switzerland?
Yeah.
Yeah, one of those places.
And their latest album, A View from Afar, is their second. And it's this really, it's just this really cool, thick, heavy, mixture of, traditional post-metal, sludge, stoner, and
it's kind of like heavier Elder,
mm-hmm.
right? It has that wheedling mm-hmm. to it, but it's a bit heavier. And they are from Germany, by the way.
Yes.
Yeah.
This new album is just really is definitely one of my favorite releases of this kind so far this year.
I think it comes back to what I said about Groove. You know, they take the post-metal formula and instead of... it's more post-metal than rock, right? Mm-hmm. And instead of falling into the template, they mix it up. They make it more interesting. It's more varied. It goes places, which I really, really like. And that leads me to the second release that I wanted to talk about, which is Flora. Mm. With The Bottom. So Flora are a post-rock band. I covered their debut on the blog, what was it, 2014? Mm-hmm. I think it was one of the first bands that I did a post-rock post for. And they're really cool. They play this math-rock, post-rock blend. Very colorful, like their name and their album covers should tell you all you need to know about the band. And they just released The Bottom, which is a big step forward from their debut, which was nice but kind of lacked staying power. But this is really, really catchy. So it's post-rock with all these very bright, very mathy influences, and again very varied. You don't see every track coming. You don't see that slump and then build up and then crescendo. It's more about expression and rhythm and flow. They're just really good. And the last band, you want to say something?
No, I mean, mostly just adding to it. I absolutely adore this album. This is like the perfect, hits that perfect middle ground of, post-rock and math rock and that sort of like weird middle ground where it's like not really firmly in either camp. And, you know, you have a lot of, it's weird. It's kind of funny how like the tracks on the album are kind of split up between these longer songs that are, you know, a bit more traditional post-rock and take their time with the compositions. And then you'll just have like, you know, a track in the middle that's just like this more furious and mathy thing. It's just really cool.
Yeah. And the complete opposite of that is Soldat Hans. So this album, I've been kind of depressed for a week, and I'm pretty sure this album is to blame. How do I describe this album? Okay, the bees made honey in the lion's skull, but way more depressing, and it got on a bus and it crashed into Godspeed You Black Emperor. Or like Simon said, it's like listening to Godspeed if I had drank like a full glass of cough syrup beforehand. So it's just slow doom drone, but then on top of it, all these beautiful brass instruments and post-rock touches, all these really lush synths. The album is called S Tout, and it comes out this Friday, and I want to recommend it to you, but I don't want to be liable for the emotional damage that this album is going to cause you. I've been completely obsessed with it. I've listened to it like dozens of times ever since I found it via the inbox, by the way. All bless the inbox. Last week, it's just amazing. If you liked any of the things that I referenced, you really, really, really owe it to yourself to listen to this album. And they're also from Switzerland, which is becoming kind of a thing, right? We have Mountain, yeah. Hubris. Now these guys, I bet I can, in a completely different setting, Shamash, the great black metal project that we've talked about several times here. There's a really kicking musical scene now. So
we're seeing a lot of stuff from both Germany and Switzerland.
Yeah. And I mean, but Germany isn't new. Germany has been like a hotbed for music ever since the 60s. Mm-hmm. But Switzerland, I know that they do have a history of music, but it kind of lulled. And now we're seeing, at least in our scenes, we're seeing like this huge proliferation of music from there. It's really interesting. But you checked out S Tout as well, right? What did you think?
I did. I finally got through the whole thing. So like the first track is what, 28 minutes?
27 minutes, yeah. Story of the Flood.
It took me a while to dedicate myself to getting through the whole thing, because it's not that it's unpleasant to listen to, but it's uncomfortable at times. It's uncomfortably slow.
Yeah.
Like you feel like what Simon said, you just kind of feel drugged through a lot of that first track. And it's definitely interesting. I really I found myself really intrigued by it. But I actually ended up liking the other two tracks on the album a lot more.
They're more palatable a bit, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Palatable and just kind of allowed a bit more light and contrast to come through, I felt.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Just listen to it. It's one of those, you know, cliches. Listen to it and make up your own mind, because it's so unique. Okay, more good things. Heavy Blog has 20,000 likes on Facebook. Yay. So these numbers, which obviously make no sense. The only reason we're talking about them is that we're humans and we like round numbers and patterns and all that stuff. But they're a good excuse to kind of look at where we are and what we've done and where we're going. So we're not going to do all that today because it's going to take hours. But it kind of afforded me some time to think about two things. One, and this has been very topical this past week, is Facebook. Facebook has been all over the news. The stock plummeted. Whatever. Mark got asked again if he's a lizard person.
There was a breach of trust.
Is that a pun?
Oh, no. That's what they've said in response to being told that there was a breach of data. It wasn't a breach of data. It was a breach of trust.
Yeah. There was a whole semantic circus there with them trying to. Anyway, Facebook. So, like, it's a cliche by now to say that Facebook sucks for pages, sucks for small businesses. The figure is usually that if you have less than $1,000 each month to put into advertising, don't bother. And I found that to be kind of incorrect. So Facebook is depressing and it is hard for small businesses to use. And I'm not sure that we're doing a good job of it, but I am sure that we're doing better as we go along. And we've learned a few things on this track to 20K and what works. And I think it'd be interesting to talk about that because it has a lot to do with fan engagement and why people read the blog. So the thing about Facebook is that it doesn't create sticky visitors. It creates people who will engage with your posts and then move on. And you know that from the pages that you interact with. How many pages do you have that you actually put into the search bar on Facebook and go and visit? Mostly you scroll the feed and what you see is what you engage with. So the trick is to create content on your site that is then published via Facebook and that draws people back in. So that's why we went with the curated columns. Postlock Post, Doomsday, Death's Door, Cult Column, Grind My Gears, all that stuff. It keeps people coming back. And I don't mean that in the marketing sense, you know, we have a captured audience and we can squeeze that cow for its milk. It's also good for the readers. They know which writers they want to look out for. They can mark their calendar. Just like I have a notification for a new Nightville episode, right? It allows you to consume the blog in an easier way. And for that, Facebook is good. It's good for that because it gives people access to everything you publish in one place. And no matter how good your site is, it's not going to be as clean and as straightforward and as content focused as Facebook.
Right.
That's one part of my rant. So do you have anything to add to that?
No, other than, you know, the move towards curated content isn't any sort of like cynical ploy on our parts, you know, to try to squeeze out what remaining you know, views we can get from our readership. It's looking at how things have changed in terms of how we access and browse information, and, you know, saying that particularly as, you know, blogs of the format are kind of dying, what purpose they can serve in this age is more as, you know, kind of aggregators in themselves and, you know, places that people can quickly go to see kind of the best information, the best data in clean packages.
Yeah, and that's the other relationship to Facebook. That's exactly the problem with Facebook. That's the whole storm that's happening right now. We don't, as consumers, just want them to hold our data and then funnel it. We want them to curate it. We want them to be a stopgap and say, you can have this data and you can't. And here's how I'm going to feed that data back to you. And that's often people's complaints. It was the same thing with trending topics and that whole scandal. So at HeavyBlog, we consume a ton of data. We listen to a ton of music and we want to be that stopgap that then trickles back to the readers the best stuff. And you know which flavor of stopgap you like the best. Who is the best filter for your taste? Because you can't listen to everything. And we don't even listen to everything. We listen to 5%. You listen to 2%. So who is the person who you trust to take out the 3% of the stuff that he listens to that you don't like, and feed you the rest? So that's kind of the vision that we have for the blog and how we see the blog moving forward. And then the second thing I wanted to say, I've said this a bunch of times when I shared, you know, big milestones on the Facebook and stuff like that. It's amazing the power that this thing can have on the lives of the people involved in it. When I shared the 20K thing, I said, you know, it saved some of our lives. And I was 100% honest. Like, I started writing for the blog at the lowest point of my life. And it gave me so much. I mean, it gave me friends like you know, lifelong friends like you and Noyan and Simon and Kyle and Jimmy and other people on the blog. It gave me security. It gave me, you know, the feeling that people were listening, that people cared about me. And it's not done that just for myself. It's done it for a bunch of people on the blog. And for other people who didn't need it like as a lifeline, it's opened them to so many things. So many, a point of pride that we have is how many writers went on to write for other publications. And some of them have a career now and they started at HeavyBlog. So I you know, on the podcast, we bitch a lot. And you and I, we bitch a lot in private messages. But I really and truly and honestly love this thing called Heavy Blog. And 20K was really like a milestone for me to look back and say, fuck, this is amazing. It, like I said in the post, it doesn't work without readers and listeners and people listening right now. It just doesn't work without that. I've started so many things in life, like blogs and stuff like that, that got closed because no one read them. So without an audience, this doesn't exist. So,
yeah, I mean, the fact that we can share something or premiere something and that means something to people, you know, people yeah. will share it from our page and, you know, get really excited about it because we posted it is like one of the coolest and most surreal things for any of us who write for here.
Yeah. And on that note, it's shill time. if you're looking to support the blog further than you already do by listening and reading, which is already amazing, we have shirts. We kind of put it in the notes, but we didn't really talk about it on the cast. We designed these with Caroline Harrison, who's worked with Piron and Yauja and a bunch of other bands. She's amazing. At Caroline Draws, right? That's her,
yes. Yep. Instagram handle.
Yeah, go check her out. She's fantastic. And she was a pleasure to work with. And she got this really cool design together. And 1000 Arms, that post-doc label that we talked about, they're doing our printing and distribution and anything. And they're so professional. Oh my God. Like working with them kind of makes me insecure about myself because they're professional on a level that I'm, God damn it, another motorcycle. Just like last week. they're professional on a level that is insane. Like they're so accurate, they're so on point, they're so receptive. So head on over to the site or check it out in the notes. We use the money, we funnel it back into the blog. None of us are gonna get rich from Heavy Blog. We make a bunch, like not a couple but a few bucks, less than 10 on every shirt, and we put it back into the blog. So if you're looking for a way to support us, that's the way to go.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing that to say about that is, it supports us and helps us keep the lights on. But it does also, yeah. When we say we put it back into the blog, we mean we're putting it back into projects and ideas for things that we want to do for all of you. We want to do some really cool stuff, and we have a bunch of ideas that we've kind of thrown around, and some stuff that we're going to be actually doing this year, including sending one of our writers to a Synthwave festival to cover all of it.
Yeah, and up and coming acts especially. And I have a lot of dreams of, you know, some of those post-doc scenes, you know, going there, doing like big journalistic pieces on them. And we have even bigger dreams than that. And all that money goes into that. Keeping the lights on, okay, fine. But it also goes into a piggy bank. And we smash it when we have these really cool projects that we want to jump on. So it's a really good way to give us more fuel. And it also says, yes, we like you guys. We like what you're doing. We will support you. And it just gives us this little boost of serotonin. Whenever we see, you know, people buying our shirts, just makes us feel good about ourselves. And hey, that's a good thing. But now it's time to feel bad. It's time to hate everything. There have been some problematic news in the musical world this week. So let's go from the outskirts and then go deeper and deeper into metal. So the first thing is guns. That's not controversial. We've had two musicians expressing surprising. Is that the word he used?
Surprising in very different ways.
Yeah. So you take this one. Right. I think you'll do a better job.
Yeah. All right. So surprisingly, first off, this is not involving anything metal. Thank God, because I legitimately do not want to hear gun, like, views on gun politics for most of the metal bands that we cover. Like, I just don't. So first one was Taylor Swift, who one could say is notoriously a bit
apolitical
to the point of being hugely problematic when it comes to anything remotely controversial or political. Posted on her Instagram a couple of days ago prior to yesterday's or Saturday's national, actually global marches in favor of greater gun control. Posted on her Instagram a statement in support of the marches, and she wrote, "No one should have to go to school in fear of gun violence, or to a nightclub, or to a concert, or to a movie theater, or to their place of worship. I've made a donation to show my support for the students, for the March for Our Lives campaign, for everyone affected by these tragedies, and to support gun reform." So that's like, that's a pretty big move for her.
Yeah.
And it does not at all erase the things that she has not said along the way. Specifically when it comes to some more controversial support from certain fan bases and the way that they've used her image. We've
spoken about it in the past in the mm-hmm. cast. You could just come out and say it. Like, the alt-right yes. has made Taylor Swift the Aryan goddess, and she hasn't deigned to say anything about that. Even though she was asked pointedly about it several times, she just shied away from it. So regardless of your political position on gun control, and it's a discussion that we can have, it's a complicated topic. Mm-hmm. Her coming out in favor of one position is very not in keeping with the image that she has fostered for herself.
I think that's as much indicative of the feeling right now among teenagers and young adults that might be breaking a bit with older generations when it comes to this issue. There does seem to be kind of a big groundswell in and new energy in kind of challenging our, you know, the conventional wisdom on what can actually be done about gun violence in at least America.
Yeah, and I mean, this is her fan base.
Mm-hmm.
This is very much where she prospers. So again, I don't want to sound too cynical. I don't know what's going on in her heart of hearts or whatever. But I would assume that this move is calculated, just like, the rest of her political image is calculated. This seems like a very, fortuitous and, advantageous time to come out in support. So I don't know what to make of this. It kind of strikes me as false. In relation to the other issues that she's chosen to be silent on. It's funny, the banner image for this article has an iHeartRadio logo behind her, which is just declared bankruptcy. So maybe that says something about the music industry, I don't know. So yeah, again, surprising, weird, maybe dishonest, maybe not, statement from her.
Mm-hmm.
Time will tell.
Yeah, so, and then another kind of like on the other weird side of surprising actions taken in the past few days regarding views on guns. So you have Killer Mike, most notoriously of Run the Jewels.
Yeah. And Bernie Sanders' campaign.
Bernie Sanders, black friend. So Mike has been pretty forthright in his overall stance on being pro-gun. And it comes from a very deeply complicated place in history of racial politics when it comes to gun control. So we're not going to talk about that here because that is way above what we are qualified to do, particularly on this podcast.
Yeah.
The controversial aspect of this is coming about because he appeared on in a video with a friend of his who hosts a TV or a I don't know, but I guess it's on the NRA TV's actual TV platform as well as their web platform. On this show for the NRA. And, you know, he was talking about, you know, his support for guns, how he doesn't support the Parkland protests, how he told his son that if, you know, that we don't support this, and if you support it, then, you know, basically you can get out of my house. You know, this other stuff. And it's just, it's weird. It's a weird decision that he made. Particularly because the NRA has a deeply, deeply problematic history and relationship when it comes to issues of racism and racial violence.
Yeah, and white supremacy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Again, we're not going to open the incredibly nuanced discussion about people of color and, by the way, other subalterns like people who suffer from mental issues and other oppressed minorities needing access to guns. It's a very, very complicated discussion, but it's definitely not a good reason to go with the NRA. There are other rifle associations in America. There's a socialist rifle association. I'm not saying maybe you're not a socialist, but I would think the gap between you and the SRA is smaller than the gap between you and the NRA if you're Killer Mike. Like an organization that was notoriously silent after Philando Castile was shot in his car, you know, even though he had a gun license and everything, was notoriously silent about mass shootings and anything involving people of color. So he's already issued a statement that he will never appear there again. But still, I think that beyond Killer Mike, it just really speaks to this feeling that musicians and celebrities in general kind of feel like they have a blank check, kind of feel like they can do whatever they want without really thinking about what those things mean. And I just can't emphasize enough how much stuff like this poisons the discourse. Because
it's frustrating because Mike has been a voice kind of crying, you know, kind of yelling about this issue and calling for more nuance and saying, you know, it's not just, you know, this black and white of guns are bad. You know, it's all mixed up in, you know, our racial history, and, you know, white allyship and progressive hypocrisy. And that's all, there is all merit to those points. But you lose so much of that nuance when you decide to appear on an NRA sponsored TV show. There's just that's just going to disappear immediately. Even if what you're talking about on that program maintains some of that nuance, the organization and the people who support it and the people who view it and share it are not going to maintain that nuance and are just going to use it as ammunition to further their own twisted views.
Yep. So moving on to something, well, a bit less bad before we go into the really bad things.
The worst.
Washington Post originally posted about this thing, about how supposedly CDs and vinyls are now outselling digital downloads for the first time since 2011. And that's kind of bullshit. So what's actually happening is that last year saw a decline in both the sales of physical media and a much larger decline in the sales of digital downloads and digital sales. So physical media fell by 4% and digital downloads fell by 25%, which is huge. And they kind of made like a clickbaity title out of it, for those sweet, sweet clicks. And basically are lying. So before you get into the vinyl and CD thing, which I 100% agree with you, I just want to say how depressing this is, especially because we know that a lot of that decline in digital downloads went to streaming services, because they grew by 50%. And we know, because we spoke about it last week, how fucked up those models are for artists. So basically, it continues the trend of listeners saying, I don't really care how I get my music. As long as it's the most convenient, I don't give a shit if the artist is fucked on the other end. I just don't care. And I think that the decline will be more substantial as we move along. Now talk about why vinyl is shit.
Yeah. I mean, first off, just to echo, I fucking hate this story. I hate it so much. And I hate the headline. I hate the hook. I just hate everything about it, because it's this shitty, misleading thing that totally buries the lead on what's actually happening, which is just that no one is buying music, period.
Yep.
They're just not buying it. The one caveat here that people say is, vinyl sales are continuing to grow and have been, over the past decade. And that's true. There's been a cottage industry within music journalism, I feel like, this popped up just chronicling the uncharted growth of vinyl, that, this train that's never going to slow down. And it's bullshit. It's a bullshit narrative.
Like, it's just more than that. That's called a bubble.
Mm-hmm.
And bubbles always burst.
Right.
The house always wins. A decade is nothing. It's nothing. And at some point, this bubble is going to burst. And we've spoken about this before on the cast. And the signs are there. The backlogs, the demand exceeding the supply, record store day fucking everyone over, including themselves. And when it does collapse, it's going to be fucking ugly.
Yeah.
And so much money is going to be lost, and so many jobs are going to be lost, just because people can't get it through their head that mono product cultures don't work. Just doesn't work. We've seen it like from the dawn of fucking time. If you're making one product, you're going to be fucked.
Yep. And the thing that I cite a lot that I don't see covered and mentioned a lot, which is surprising to me, because I've looked at the past few years of these annual reports released by Nielsen. And I wrote about this pretty extensively last year. I didn't end up doing it this year just because the data, like 95% of it, basically just reinforced all the things I said last year. You can see if you chart out the top selling vinyls year by year, you see this trend of what started out being, this kind of excitement over new releases, pop releases, rock, whatever, being very quickly subsumed by legacy releases. So albums that have been, either popular albums, maybe from, 3 to 5 years ago or a decade ago, or you have your evergreens, Beatles,
Hendrix,
just
Floyd,
all of those. And that is not a sign of a healthy market at all. If your primary product is built on this nostalgia factory, it's not going to lead to sustained growth.
Yeah, and drilling down into the format itself, I don't have a problem with people who collect vinyl. I don't have a problem with vinyl or even CDs as niche products. But I do have a problem with them as the number one format for the distribution of music. It's a bad idea. First of all, it's classist. Not everybody can spend the amount of money that vinyl now costs for new albums. It's just insane. Some of the turntables are super expensive. Same thing with CDs. They break. They cost money. You need a CD player for them.
CDs are actually a garbage format. Like,
CDs suck. Yeah, we spoke about it a few weeks ago on the cast. CDs are terrible. And I think that vinyl is terrible as well. It's so limiting. I get the collection, the special edition value of it. I have like 5 vinyl myself. I never play them. Some of them were bought for me as a gift. I bought one of them, the Yindi Halda thing, just because I wanted to support the band. It was a cool vinyl. But pretending like this can be the number one channel of distribution is just lies. And we keep pouring money into this thing that doesn't get more music into more hands, which digital, for all its problems and all its limitations, does. It just does that. It gets more people listening to new music. And it just seems like just a fucking waste of money. It's like renting instead of buying a house, right? Mm-hmm. You can already buy the house, but you just keep renting because the apartment you can rent is cooler. It's dumb. It's throwing money down the drain. We need to invest this money. We need to focus on making digital better, on solving streaming, on solving digital distribution, on solving copyright. And instead, it's so primitive. Like, I can go full transhuman on this and say, you're putting information into a fucking rubber. That is so primitive and backwards. We don't need to do it anymore. It's mind boggling, but there's no stopping the nostalgia train until it stops, and then people are going to be fucked.
Mm.
Okay. So
we can't avoid this any longer.
Yes. From the doom of next year to the doom of this year. Metal is a trash fire. I don't know if you've noticed. Like, 95% of the people involved in this genre are fucking shit, like human waste. And they have terrible regressive views and outlooks. And this includes both the musicians and the fans. I'm not giving anyone a pass here. So let's start with the Faceless. The Faceless have broken up again. Everybody is left except for Michael Keane. All 3 musicians involved posted a coordinated announcement saying that they are leaving. It was very obvious. It was coordinated and a template in which they thanked each other but didn't thank him, and thanked the manager, who's really keeping the band together these days. And instantaneously, the speculation started, and it's not speculation at this point. And I feel like it's at a place where we can talk about it. Allegedly, everything here, just imagine that I say allegedly before it. I hope that holds up in court. Michael Keane has a substance abuse issue.
Yes.
And this has been kind of like an open secret in the industry for years, and now it's coming out. One of the band members replied to his Instagram post saying that he's going to get new members and said, why don't you own up to your problems, own up to your shit, that you don't rehearse and you don't make shows, all because of the substance abuse, and that you like sold our gear when it was locked away for safekeeping because you needed money for your addiction and stuff like that. And the fan base reacted by making memes and making fun of Michael Keane. So what the fuck?
This is so infuriating. It's at a time when the nation, you know, certainly in America, is claims that it wants to be so focused on this very real issue of opioid use, opioid addiction, and all the fallout from that.
And mental health.
And everything. And everyone agrees, oh, it's this big issue. It's serious. It's something that we really need to take care of. And, you know, let's put aside the fact that fucking next to nothing is actually being done about it. Yeah. We're still, you know, arguing whether people who suffer from opioid addiction deserve, you know, treatment or deserve to be given Naxalene. What's it called?
I don't remember the name.
The, you know, drug that basically will save someone in an overdose.
Yeah.
You know, so that people are so instinctively going to this place of ridiculing Keane's addiction, and turning it into this, you know, this big meme of, oh, you know, you know, oh, there goes Keen again. Can't do anything because of this addiction. Then it's, you know, it's all his fault and whatever. And it's just, it's not just in poor taste. It's just,
it's callous. Yes. It's cruel. Like, okay, I'm not saying that I don't understand. And this is not the other member's fault. Like, they've been burnt. I'm not saying that they don't have a legitimate issue with this guy. Like, I'm sure they poured a ton of money into this and he fucked them. Not to mention their manager or his manager now, who's been trying to make the Faceless happen for over a decade now. And for anybody else who knows an addict, I'm not saying that addicts are beyond reproach and you can't, you know, take actual grievance with their actions and they don't have responsibility. But these people need our help.
Yeah.
They don't need pity. They don't need callous jokes. They don't need us to make fun of them. They need our help. They're suffering from a condition, right, from an illness.
Right. Yeah. The thing here is that we and no one is saying that Keen is not responsible for the actions that he's taken or for the repercussions that it's produced. He's not responsible to his fans for the many times that they've canceled shows, for the money that he owes, for all that. He is responsible for that. But at the end of the day, who is actually going to be looking out for him and have his interests in mind to help make him better and to help make this situation right?
Yeah. At the end of the day, no one, except for, you know, maybe his manager, the people who are close to him. We can only hope that the situation goes somewhere. Like, it's such a fucking shame. Like, one of the most talented bands, one of the most promising bands in the genre, just is stuck in a cycle. And if we go again to the macrocosmos of, like, the macro level of this entire thing, it just shows you how bad this shit is, how bad the opioid problem that you have in America is, and how little is being done to address the problems at the root of this, which is poverty and mental health and systematic classism and a bunch of other things. We just, a generation, an entire generation is being lost to this shit. And if you don't, if you're this callous asshole and you don't care about whatever random Joe somewhere that you see a picture of after he OD'd, okay, I'll use this example. A talented person, a talented musician, someone who could have been amazing, could have been great. His talent is being robbed of us because of this thing. So if you don't care about the other people and you're that callous, at least here, when the example is so in your face and it's so clear what is being lost, I would expect people to understand that. But instead, they're just being assholes. So speaking of assholes, there's a band called Decapitated who are assholes. As we've said, they were indicted in the States during tour following an accusation of rape and sexual assault. And their case was dropped because of the mental health of the accuser, who couldn't handle the pressure of being interrogated and being picked at and social media and all that stuff, and then lied about it and said that they were found innocent, which is just not true, and went on to victim blame and victim shame and all that beautiful stuff. And now they're doing it again. They have this announcement of, we're back, and no one on social media says the truth anymore. And we were found innocent, but our names are forever besmirched. Like, if Decapitated crashed on a plane back to Poland, I would not shed a single tear. Honestly. I cannot stress how fucking damaging their statement is. How damaging it is in furthering rape culture, in misleading people about how the legal system works, in just fucking up this entire situation. And of course, the comment sections are full of these devil's advocates and these people defending them and freedom of speech. I'm honestly so sickened by this. I can't even, you know, go into detail because it's already happened so many times. And the last thing I want to say about this is just shows how long of a road this community has to go. How ingrained, these ideas of power and abuse and what the legal system is about are in our scene. It's just so depressing.
Yeah. Only thing I can add to that is this is just yet another example of people not understanding how the U.S. justice system works.
Yeah.
And, you know, people thinking that it deals in these absolute verdicts of innocent and guilty. It's black and white. And so often, the vast majority of cases don't come to that. And we're gonna get to that in a second, actually, in our next thing. The vast majority of cases don't even reach an innocent or guilty verdict.
And even if they do, the school of thought that thinks that courts actually administer justice and say what is right or wrong died in the 19th century. Courts do not determine who is innocent or guilty. Courts determine what is provable under the judicial system.
Right.
They make a verdict on what has been proved in court. They do not, in most places, aspire to this epistemological ability of telling truth from lies. It's just their approximation. It's as close as we can get as a society.
The legal system, the legal system is not built to handle issues of sexual assault and rape. Not only is it not built, it's structured intentionally to favor perpetrators.
Yeah.
And,
but I'm not even saying that. I'm not even saying like the slant and the bias. Like
What I'm saying though is that it is extremely difficult to present evidence and present a case in which you can produce a verdict, you know, a verdict that is guilty. And it's just, in cases like these, we really will never know what happened.
Yeah. Yep. Like I said previously, it's just super depressing. And the fact that, you know, people go from "I don't believe the victim" to "I believe the perpetrator" so easily is just sickening. Speaking of sickening, there's a band called Inquisition, and one of the main members of that band is Dagon. And, you know, a guy who calls himself Dagon is already going to be up to no good. And apparently, allegedly, wait, not allegedly, he took a plea settlement, right?
Yes.
He consumed, did he also spread? He took part in child pornography. And, you know, when this first came out, I was like, okay, this is as clear cut as it gets, right? Child pornography is bad. Even in our postmodern age, I think that we as a community can agree on this. But apparently, we can't. It is enough for this guy to make a statement in which he says, this was a decade ago. Why is it being brought up now? And I took a plea settlement on this trial and not deny in any part of his post that he did those things, because he can't, because he took a settlement and he can't deny that he did those things, and have hundreds of people flock to his defense.
Yeah. All right. Just to back up a bit, this is coming out because of a couple of events. So I forget what day it was exactly that Metal Sucks posted this this article in which they obtained court documents from Washington State, I believe, of this case. And they apparently, in the process of this investigation, they contacted Season of Mist, who is who was Inquisition's label as of a couple of days ago. They supposedly, refused to comment on record at the time to Metal Sucks, but then a day or so later came out with a very, very brief statement saying Season of Mist is no longer working with Inquisition, and basically that's it.
Yeah. So I want to say a few things here. First of all, this is a new low. I really didn't think I would see so many people rallying behind this person. And again, it's under the same guise of black metal is supposed to be shocking. It's supposed to break taboos. You can break taboos without abusing fucking minors and kids. Okay? You can do that. And you know what? I'm even going to go out on a limb here and say, yes, we as a society have a discussion that we need to have at some point about pedophilia. We need to have a discussion about it, because it's, while I think it's a terrible thing, the people who suffer from it have been demonized by media and by the legal system, and we don't handle them properly nowadays. And I'll even go one step further and say that the sex offender list is also a problematic concept, and there is a nuanced discussion to be had about these things. But this case is pretty fucking clear cut, guys. It's pretty black and white. We're not talking about someone who had an incident or thoughts or suffered from issues. We're talking just about a guy who consumes on a regular basis, consumes child pornography. That's one. Two, it's very nice of Season of Mist to disown this guy. While they have actual Nazis on their roster, because they have Shining Norway, not Shining Norway. Shining Norway are good people.
Shining Sweden. Do not besmirch more.
Yeah.
The name of Jörgen Maccabee.
Do not besmirch the Black Jazz. Shining Sweden, who are just awful people. They don't mind that shit. That's fine. Yeah. And the last thing here is, why do you feel like this guy needs an advocate? Why are you so eager to jump to his defense? Let's say you don't 100% know that he did those things, even though you do. Let's say that you think the legal system is problematic and he was handed a bad cards. Doesn't it put you off just a little bit, even the possibility of this being true? Doesn't it keep you from defending him when you don't actually know anything? Why are people so eager to jump to his defense? It's just inconceivable to me. I can't wrap my mind around that instinct.
I honestly don't even know what to add, because I'm in the same exact boat. What the thing that gets me is that we live in a world where there is just such an overabundance of great music in every corner.
Yeah.
Every genre. Just take your pick. There is a whole league of bands, new and old, who have created and are currently creating great music. And there is a very large percentage of them who have not watch, supposedly, hopefully, not watch child pornography, who are not either clandestine or outspoken white supremacists or neo-fascists or outright Nazis.
Yeah.
And it's this knee-jerk reaction to automatically back and defend every single one of these individuals and bands, because somehow, you know, the idea is if you don't defend all of them, then like the whole thing is lost, is just bullshit. It is total and complete bullshit. the
protecting the fragile flower that is black metal.
Like, if Inquisition just disappeared, just was wiped clean off the face of the earth, black metal would not be any worse.
Yeah.
The like, it would not have any effect on the music that is being created now.
Yep. I agree. And even if it wasn't just them, even if you, like, took away all these fucked up people, all these Nazis and white supremacists and all these people, and they just stopped making their music, black metal would still be able to be abrasive and challenging and aggressive. Like, there's so many things that you can question that are more interesting than saying that all people of color should be killed. How is that questioning anything? I don't know what happened to this planet where fascism became revolutionary. But it happened, and it's fucked up and it's depressing. Okay. Cool people time. Tell us, Nick, what have you been up to?
I'm really bad with keeping up with video games. So okay. I'm not at all, you know, at the level that you and Noyan and a bunch of others are at. I'm currently playing through Witcher 3 for the first time.
That's a good game.
Yeah.
That's a good game.
I'm enjoying it.
How's the FOMO treating you?
The what?
The FOMO?
Oh.
The fear of missing out because the game is so fucking huge. Yeah.
Yeah. I've sort of I've resigned myself to telling myself at some point I'll go back and just do a big wipe through of all the undiscovered areas and shit. I honestly don't know if it's ever going to happen, but
yeah,
I'm enjoying it. There are certain things that kind of annoy me a bit, and I'll play a lot, sort of do tandem gaming with my wife Sarah, who is also into games and RPGs and stuff, but she specifically has, basically said that she's glad that she's not playing Witcher because a lot of the writing is just so over the top. With the degradation of women and I don't know. It's this weird thing where, writers and game makers, game designers and whatever, say, oh, we're trying to be, realistic and authentic, but it's this very specific version of what they think is realistic and authentic.
Yeah.
And yep. It's just, I don't know. It's a bit of a turnoff.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it also breaks up the tone of the game. So much of the game is actual realism within the fantasy setting, right? Mm-hmm. And things make sense. And then suddenly there's a sorceress who appears from out of nowhere and they have sex. It's just, I know what you're saying.
Yeah, it's just, it just falls into these weird, dumb tropes that no one is at all, required to follow, but some reason, it's just agreed that, you have to do it this way.
Yeah. What else? What else have you been consuming?
Yeah, I've been watching a lot of the new CW superhero show, Black Lightning. Mm.
How is it?
I like it. It's very CW-y. It's no one is going to argue that it's this super well written, well produced piece of art. But it's really interesting. For one thing, it is not at all, at least so far, connected to the Arrowverse, which thank fucking God. there's one more show that they tried to, rope in there, just, ugh. Particularly at a time, when there's a kind of a lot of discussion about black superheroes, with Black Panther and everything. Mm-hmm. This takes a much different, smaller scale perspective of, just this one guy who, came to these powers, tried to use them to help his city and avenge his father, stopped using them for a decade, became principal of, you know, of this school in the city, that's like, you know, becomes like a leader of the community and everything, but then mm-hmm. is kind of like cajoled into using his powers again because the city is under threat, and, you know, it comes out that other members of his family also have inherited these powers, and it's just it's a really interesting exploration of family dynamics and small scale, you know, local dynamics and the use of powers and violence and everything.
Interesting. I'll put that on my list. Mm. There's also Cloak and Dagger coming soon,
mm.
which also features an African-American superhero and I think a white counterpart. But that's kind of the thing in the comics, right? He's Shadow and she's Light, and they have like this cool interaction with their powers. So it will be interesting to see what they do. Mm-hmm. I don't have anything new that I really wanted to talk about. I spoke about Vermintide last time. I started this book, Nine Fox Gambit, partly from Noyan's recommendation and partly from this list I read somewhere. It's a space opera, and it's really weird. Like, the main concept is this galactic empire, and it runs on a calendar. Like, the fact that it can enforce one calendar across, you know, hundreds of planets, to the extent that when you stray away from that calendar, you become a heretic because it fucks up their technology. Like, their engines run on these mathematical formulas. So if you choose a different set of algorithms or whatever, you kind of start poisoning this empire. That's a really unique concept. I haven't read it anywhere else. It's pretty cool so far. I'm 70 pages in. It's pretty inventive. It suffers from the issues of space opera, but so far it's pretty original, which is saying something for the genre.
Nice. Oh, one other thing I wanted to mention. Yeah. Do you watch Atlanta at all?
I saw the first season. Is the second one already playing?
Yeah. So there are like 3 or 4 episodes in now.
And yeah, I wonder if I can get it here. Is it on Netflix?
It's FX.
I can't get FX here.
Yeah. It's one of those shows that I have almost an impossible time describing.
Yeah, I really like the first season.
Mm-hmm. So far the second season is just like more. It's like, yeah. It's all those like really kind of quirky, almost surrealist aspects, just like, but more.
Yeah. It's surreal, dark comedy, drama,
mm-hmm.
something like that. Go watch
but
it.
Also,
watch
but also season. Just ridiculously funny. Like,
yeah. And it has great music.
Mm-hmm. Great music, great actors. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That's it for this week. Thank you for listening. Next week, we'll see. The future is unknowable and God is dead. Have a great week. Bye-bye.
Bye. Wrap around.